right club.
Be the right club today.
Yes! Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything different?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the No Laying Up Podcast. Solly here. I am stoked, absolutely stoked about today's interview with Hunter Mahan. Chatted with him last week about pretty much everything under the sun. We, you know, I really tried to start with all the good stuff and then leading into some of his struggles of late, but he steered right into talking about the struggles. So much Ryder Cup stuff in this. Some really, really great perspective. I can't wait for you guys to listen to it. Want to give a shout out to our friends at Whoop, WHOOP.com. You can use promo code NOLAYINGUP, all one word, for 15% off at checkout. I got to be honest, I've let my Whoop die last week and I couldn't find the charger for it. I finally found it today, got it rebooted. And I'll admit, the time that I was, you know, where my Whoop was dead, I let things slip. I didn't have that thing there to hold me responsible for getting to bed on time, getting enough sleep, not drinking as much, you know, actually, you know, learning when to put strain on my body, knowing what my body was going to be doing on a certain day based on how well recovered I was. I let it slip, and I'm back. I'm plugged in. I'm back in the game. And it goes to show that, one, I just need some accountability. I need something to hold me responsible. It gives you great data on, you know, how often you're waking up during the course of the night, what your resting heart rate is overnight, your heart rate variability. If you want your body to perform well, you need a Whoop. Go to whoop.com, WHOOP. It's a fitness wearable. You wear it all day. You can shower with it. It is way easier to charge than I would lead you to believe. Whoop.com, use promo code NOLAYINGUP for 15% off at checkout. Let's get to Hunter Mahan. So I did a little research, as I'm wont to do, and I hear you're a huge gearhead. And when I heard that, I was like, oh, okay, I mean, whatever. He's into golf equipment, whatever. But I hear it's not golf equipment. It's in the actual garage. Where does that passion come from?
Yeah, you know, it became a little bit of a thing when I joined the tour, got a little bit of money, and then I started buying some cars. And, you know, my dad is really into that stuff, and we would go to car shows when I was a kid. I wouldn't by any means call myself a gearhead. I think I just like cars, and, you know, when I was single and had some money, I would spend some money on them and have all kinds of different ones. I kind of liked having, like, a variety more than I liked maybe say having like a super nice one. You know, it's just something that I kind of enjoyed at the time. I'm definitely not as into now. I just don't have the time for it. But I do like it. I think it's something that's so the mechanical engineering perspective of it and how things work. I think it's just so neat and so cool to see. You know, we built a couple cars years ago, and to see it kind of transform, I think is so neat. And I think I almost liked the process of seeing it grow and then driving. And then I'd be like, okay, I want to do something else. So it was, you know, I liked seeing it kind of go from these guys would make it from parts. And I like kind of the designing aspect of it, maybe more so than the actual, you know, getting under a hood and actually doing anything. But I think anything with design, I've always kind of liked.
That's interesting. You mentioned money there a couple times and being single and starting to get some money. So I want to ask, well, what's it like to be young and just like kind of have a big influx of money come in very quickly due to successes you have on the golf course as well? But sounds like, you know, you had some spending habits with that money. But what's that like to kind of, you know, have that happen at a young age?
Oh my gosh, I wish I could go back in time and give myself advice. But when you're young, the only person you think about is yourself. And that's not in a selfish standpoint. That's just
it's what you know.
Yeah. I'm 23. I'm an only child as well. So, you know, 23, 24, 25, I really was just focused on getting my career going and feeling stabilized in that. So that's the only thing I really thought about. You know, I got a great opportunity with Ping coming right out of college, and I just was living by myself, and you know, I didn't even know what I wanted, right? And I just practiced and played all the time. And I guess I had money, but I really had no sense of scope of like how much and what I could spend and how long it would last me if I couldn't play golf anymore. It's clearly, I didn't know what I didn't know at the time. And I wish I could go back and tell myself, listen, you're going to like this, but you're really not going to enjoy it as much as you think you would. But, you know, it was, I feel pretty lucky to have the opportunities that I had as a young person, and to be where I am today. I feel extremely lucky to be, you know, sitting here today.
Well, two things I want to unpack from that. One, you said you're not going to enjoy it as much as you think you would. I'd like to know kind of what that means. One, and two, what you would have told yourself, what else you would have told yourself, you know, about like what to do with money, or because from what I gather, I don't at least I'm not aware of, the tour doesn't do any financial training or anything like that, which I think some of the other sports leagues have started doing in somewhat recent years. But when you're coming out of college, even if you come, you know, with a college education and everything, it's not like you walk into a young career knowing exactly what to do when you do have money.
So I leave college, sign a contract with Ping, and then I'm like, okay, now I'm playing a few tour events. I go to Q School, get my card. I really was only focused about just getting my golf going, and really figuring out how am I going to do this on tour? Cause it's a daunting thing to go from college and then all of a sudden you're on your own and you're traveling and you're trying to figure out where to stay and where to eat, how to live, and really becoming the best golfer you can be and what that means. I kind of just moved around a little bit. I was kind of like, I kind of liked it over here, but I didn't know if this golf course was the best for me. And I kind of lived kind of away from Dallas, probably about 45 minutes outside. I kind of played at Vaquero at the time, but I was just kind of all by myself. My folks were much more in McKinney at the time. So I was just kind of, you know, in this kind of smaller town. And I wish I just kind of would have found a golf course, got an apartment, and just kind of stayed there for a while until I needed to upgrade and get a little bit something bigger with, you know, if I had a girlfriend or my wife, and then we'd go from there. I kind of just jumped around all the time, not really knowing what I was doing.
You need to figure out what you wanted. Take some time to figure out what you wanted. Yeah.
You don't even know what you want at that age. You're sure. Just kind of like, that sounds fun. That I'll do that. I'll live there. It's just, I was just kind of scatterbrained a little bit, but I really was only focused just on myself and my golf and sort of training and figuring out how I could be a good golfer. And, you know, luckily I actually got around a lot of good people. My financial guy I had back then, I still have today. Having someone you really trust, you hear so many sad stories about guys who do so much in their sport and make so much money, and then a bad financial guy takes it all from them. And it's just, it's so sad and ridiculous. And it's an overwhelming thing to think of a 19, 20, 20 year old kid get a bunch of money. And he actually doesn't understand that, you know, golf is great because you can have a long career, but a lot of guys have such short careers, making the money last for a long, long time. That's a really hard challenge. And to change your spending habits from when you're 24 to when you're 44, is a big deal. And it's, I think it's very daunting for those young guys who in different sports who maybe didn't really grow up with anything, and then all of a sudden they have all this money and all this access. It's very overwhelming for a young person.
Yeah, and is that what you mean by you're not going to enjoy it really as much as you thought you would as well? Does that cover that as well?
Yeah, things come and go, right? Like it's just, you know, the things I enjoyed, maybe I thought I enjoyed when I was 25, and now I'm, you know, almost 40. My life is just so much simpler than it was back then, but you're young and you don't, the only thing you're thinking about is yourself and your golf and, oh, that sounds cool. Can I get that? And, you know, he's like, yeah, you can, you know, get that car or whatever. And like, oh, that's fun. That's cool. But you're just kind of moving on from the next tournament to the next tournament with all this energy and excitement. So, you know, it's just maturing and it's just growing like any person, and your likes change and what makes you happy and what makes you stabilized changes through time.
Yeah, we started doing this podcast about 7 years ago, and I would cringe to go back and listen to kind of what I thought was kind of important at age 27 versus now I'm married and at age 34. Like, life really does change, and I think we're gonna get into some of that in the back half. But we're gonna talk a lot of golf, and I do want to kind of start with a lot of the fun stuff of your career. But I want to start kind of the golf conversation with what is your relationship with golf right now? How would you describe your relationship with golf?
You know, it's been definitely challenging for the last few years. It's just, I still enjoy practicing and sort of the grinding aspect of figuring it out and figuring out like who I, the challenge of who I was and who I am moving forward and how those are going to sort of cross paths. You know, I'm working with Sean Foley right now. And, you know, Sean was with me during the best years of my career, and I'm trying to figure out how to get back to that. And I think we've been kind of piecing it together over the past couple months. But every person, just like a fingerprint, has their own sort of identity and their own move in a way, and what they feel comfortable doing and what they can do without thinking and under pressure. And figuring out kind of what that is and kind of holding that and sticking to that is really, really challenging. And one of the parts that's been super challenging is figuring out what the actual problem is and to fix that, because it kind of feels like, is that the problem or is that what's kind of helping me hit a good shot, what that feel is? Golf is very challenging in that aspect, that it's, you know, it takes a long time to go down the wrong path. It doesn't happen overnight. It's like a real, real slow bleed. And you don't really know what happened until it's like, man, I just don't feel the same way I did when I was hitting it pure. And I would just stand up in the tee and I look at my target. My caddy would say, right at that tree. And I would just look at it and I would do it. And then when you look at that tree 5 years down the road and, all right, I'm going to hit it right there, and you don't hit it there, and it goes left of it, and then it goes right of it, you're like, huh, that's different. I'm not quite sure how to fix that. It's challenging, but I still, I wake up today, and I'm excited to go figure it out, and I do feel like I am piecing it together to where golf, I can look at it, I can trust what I'm doing, and just do it. And see where I want to go, and it does that, and I can feel it when it's good, and I can feel when it's not good, but know why it's not good.
Wow, you just answered like 18 of the questions I think I had for further down the road there. But to answer it, what I was really after there is, do you wake up still wanting with the energy that you've always had to get better and go chase it and go get it, or is it with malaise that you go through the route of, trying to figure it out? And that answers the question very well. I'm encouraged to hear that, like, you still enjoy that aspect of it and going out and go get it. And it sounds like, I don't want to generalize this to say like you were young and dumb because you had, 8, 9, 10 years of sustained success in professional golf, and a ton goes into that, but you got to play for a long period of time without having to doubt anything in your process, right? You talked about seeing that tree and hitting it right there. And then now when you, I don't want to say admit that there is a problem, but now that you know you have that problem word in there, that's what you're trying to overcome more than you are trying to hit it right at that tree. I don't know if that, how I said that makes sense.
Well, yeah, you can't be scared to say, man, I've got, it's a vulnerability is a good thing. You got to tell yourself, man, I don't get it. I called Sean after Pebble, and it was even after the first round. And I was like, I shot 67. I was like, I don't get it. I'm not feeling it or understanding it. I need help. I need, I'm missing something. And so there was a few years where I was like going to the golf course going, I got no idea what's going on. Like, I just don't feel it. I don't have a trust. I don't quite understand. And so that's really hard. And that's a very, very uncomfortable feeling to go out there and play golf and feel like, I'm not really sure what it's going to do today. And I don't know if it's going to miss left or miss right. That was very much a very tough time where I was like, I just don't really want to be out here because there is no hope, because I don't really know what the problem is. And so that was hard. And that was definitely a struggle. And like I said, it's a slow bleed, like when you see with, it's great to see Jordan Spieth come out of it. But did anyone ever think in Jordan Spieth's 20s that he would struggle to the point where he falls out of the top 50 in the world? And it's like, that's just asinine to think. The guy is just he's a grinder and he's a boss at what he does, but it's a slow bleed. It's not something that happens quickly. And so it's really hard to see the problem because it would just kind of happen overnight, but it took a while to get there. And that's the challenge of golf is you could be, it's almost kind of, when you look at Tiger's time with Hank, it was really, it was just Tiger normal. And then all of a sudden it just stopped. And you're like, it just doesn't look the same anymore. Something's off. And then he, grinded away, got with Foley and got it back again quickly. That's, it's really hard to find your DNA and understanding of what do I do And how do I get better at doing that? That's a hard question to ask because everyone's trying to get better, but it's a fine line between doing that and still keeping your DNA and what you do and why you are great at it, and you can repeat it when you need to.
Well, and it's also when you're, let's look at a 5-year sustained success period of time, right? Within that period of time, you're going to have troughs. You're going to have times when you're not as sharp. And when you're in that moment, it's impossible to know if that is the beginning of a downturn or if it's just variance within, you know, otherwise good fundamentals and sustained success, right? You don't know that it's going all the way down. You know, you could have 2 great weeks and then miss a cut, and you don't know if that's a little blip on the radar or if that is the signifying thing that things are about to go down. And I'm wondering, with you, you know, having that 7 to 8 straight years of just pure success, did you appreciate how special that was at the time? And has your perspective on, you know, what that stretch means changed at all in the last few years?
A little bit. I mean, I think the rise of going from college, a couple years on tour, I went back and forth on tour, and then I started to gain momentum and some confidence, and then got with Sean, and things started to really go to where I was really strong in what I was doing, and it was consistent, even though I felt like I could get better. And so I was still okay in some areas, but I was so consistent with my ball striking day in and day out. Ball striking is the most important thing in golf. So that's that being my strength and my driving and my iron play is what kind of propelled me for such a long time. When you're in it, you're just doing it and you're just playing and you're just a part of it. And I don't know if you do. I definitely did. I mean, all the team events to me are those moments where you feel like, wow, I am in the company of greatness. You know, I was thinking about the playing with Justin Leonard, who's someone I grew up watching and practicing next to in Dallas. And now I'm playing in a Ryder Cup with him. You know, Jack Nicklaus calling me and saying, hey, I'm going to be a part of the President's Cup team. You know, Tiger Woods tapping me on the shoulder at Harding Park on the bus on Saturday afternoon when we came up with our singles matches. And I was first off and he's like, hey, you're the first man out there. We've got to keep the momentum. You're the biggest part of that. You need to go out there and win tomorrow. Those things and those moments I look back on, I think, wow, I was a part of that. I was a part of history in a way. And I think of my career and I think, man, I'm so proud of that because that is so cool and awesome to have been in those moments and had those experiences with those guys that I grew up watching.
With success too. That's the thing that, you know, you go flip. You were on, I think, every President's Cup and Ryder Cup team between like 07 and 2011. And then you were on the 2013 President's Cup, 2014 Ryder Cup. Like you were on so many of those teams and had a crazy good record. So what, and you obviously you won the WGC match play. You've done world match play stuff. You had an incredible match play record. What at the top level, what makes a great match play player versus, you know, a 72 hole stroke play tournament? You know, you've won 5 of those events as well, but what made you excel in the match play?
I don't know. I mean, all the players are good. It's a little bit of luck. You know, I played really well at that golf course. You know, I don't know. I think it's, you know, I think you just have to enjoy it for one. You have to enjoy match play. I know some guys don't, but I just enjoyed it. I enjoyed the competition, the head-on-head, you know, like it's, you're just trying to beat that guy and you're just trying to figure it out. And I think my game lend itself to good success because I would just be so consistent fairway and green. I think I always made the other player think that he's not going to make a mistake. And there's a reason, you know, Tiger always played well in those events because he just fairways and greens. I'm just going to bore you to death almost in a way. And I'm just going to keep putting the pressure on you and making you think I'm going to do something great, even though I might not. I might just hit a good shot, but I'm never going to be in trouble. And so when you play these great, great players, it's, you know, just a little mistake and getting one down at the wrong moment, you know, could end the match. So I enjoyed it. And my ball striking always just felt like it put pressure on the other guys over and over again.
A quick break here to check in with our friends at Original Penguin. I can save you the Instagram DM. I get so many questions about what kind of hoodie I'm wearing, where are those shorts from, where are those pants from? They are so crispy. Solly, you are the best dresser of all of the... Okay, maybe that part was a little bit of a stretch. They're all from Original Penguin. I wear Original Penguin stuff every day of my life. I sleep in their shorts at night. I wear their sweatpants. I wear their hoodies on a near daily basis. I wear their golf shorts. I wear some of the... I've been kind of getting into the little shorter shorts. I feel like those are about to make a big comeback. Can't quite execute them, the look I'm after on the golf course yet, but we're working on it. I need to fill out my quads a little bit more with that. It's got everything from... you know, casual wear, dress wear, golf wear. They got a great section of what's new on their website. They got great stuff on sale. Cameron Smith is a heavily featured athlete of theirs, and we're going to have some content coming out in relation to that Original Penguin has partnered with us on in relation to Cam Smith as well. So go to originalpenguin.com. Always remember to be an original. And now let's get back to Hunter Mahan. Well, I want to go to that 2008 Ryder Cup team. You know, how you got onto that team. You know, you don't see many captain's picks going all five matches. And how Azinger went about, you know, going about, you know, getting input from players into how they were put into pods. And we can talk some about how the teams in your later part of your career were formed as well. And because that one seems to stick out to me and how that was done. So how would you compare it to, you know, later years, how teams were put together and how that team worked versus your first year in 2008?
I remember talking to Paul a couple times beforehand. I was just, you know, in and out of the team for a while. And he gave me great advice. I remember because I talked to him and I said, you know, Paul, I want to be on this team more than anything. I mean, I grew up watching the Ryder Cup. I love the passion. And I understand I got great experience from the President's Cup. I can't tell you how much it would mean to me to be a part of the team. And he told me, you know, I believe in you and I want you to be a part of this. And I want you to want it the right amount. I don't want you to want it too much and put pressure on yourself. And I don't want you to just kind of hope you make it, you know, but you know, I want you to live in that great space of wanting it just the right amount and be good to yourself and just keep doing what you're doing. Cause you're on the right path. And so that gave me a lot of confidence that he just told me that whether I made the team or not, you know, what he did was he did so many amazing things very subtly. You know, he gave a lot of ownership to the team, you know, because the pod said, hey, we want Hunter Mahan on this team. And so that little group, he gave ownership to. He said, hey, who do you guys want? And so that's how I made the team with, you know, our pod was AK, Phil, and Justin. And, you know, a lot was made of these personality tests, but he was just trying to get the right people together to play their very best. And the hardest part of it and what always seemed to, captains made some comments like, hey, he's like, I want 12 guys to bond, not just a couple in a pod. You know, they were very like adamant about, we have to be a unit of 12 guys. It's like, we're not a unit of 12 guys. We're 12 individuals trying to figure it out this week. Let's get to know who we're going to play with on an intimate level and play for the next 3-4 days to understand maybe the nuances of each other and understand how each other's going to play each hole. There's nothing wrong with that. There's no point in trying to figure out me, a player, trying to figure out 11 other guys and how they're going to play. You know, we know each other, but we're not going to play with everybody and we shouldn't have the option to play with everybody. There's going to be a small group of us that need to know each other and play well. And that, you know, we had a rough run and there was a, going into that Ryder Cup,
2014.
You know, there was so much, I mean, there was so much success of the President's Cup, but for some reason, the Ryder Cup had this, you know, a lot of the guys who've been on some tough teams said, you know, it's the most pressure you're ever going to have. You're going to be under so much stress. It's like they were kind of creating a snowball, whether they knew it or not. And we got there and it was just such a fun group. And Paul was so energetic and he just was so excited for us. He's like, I am just so proud of you. And I am just so excited in it. And I cannot wait to get out there and play. The crowd is excited. The crowd is pumped. This is just, you know, it was just an amazing thing to be a part of. And it just kind of quite hasn't, you know, I think when the U.S. has won, they've just been so talented. I mean, there's been, you know, I got to do a little bit of the BBC in Hazeltine, and that team was just unbelievably talented. That was just top to bottom. The team was a joke how good they were, and they just kind of overwhelmed Europe. But that 8 team was just so fun. And they were, I mean, it was just so fun to be a part of. And it felt like we were, even though we were in pods, man, we were a unit, and we were so excited to go out there and play in front of those fans. And we just had so much fun.
Yeah. The more you describe that, the more I'm just like, man, the atmosphere, it almost like is a tight, you know, wound tight promoted atmosphere. Other than that year, you look back, you know, like everyone talks about the pressure. You're never going to feel so much pressure like that you are in your whole life, blah, 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 all this. And what you saying about Paul, like you guys did look like you were having fun out there. And like, what is more likely to promote good golf, you know, going out and having fun and being yourself, or this expectation that you are going to be under the most pressure that you've ever been under in your whole life? Like just, I've never seen it more clearly than after you describing that, of like why these really talented teams have struggled to come up with Ryder Cup wins.
And what he did too, I thought was brilliant. It was that he sort of laid everything out before we got there. He's like, this is your pod. This is your group. This is how we're going to play the course. And we're going to, he's like, I want birdies. I want loud. I want energy. I want noise. So we're going to make it a little bit easier. We're going to take the rough down. He laid kind of everything out there for everybody. So when we got there on Monday, everything was set in stone. We just had to go play. We just had to go figure out how we're going to play the golf course. We just had to go. We didn't have to worry about anything. Everything was already done. Like, he had the matches all set up throughout the week. And then he would make little changes, right? Like, AK and I were supposed to play Saturday afternoon, but AK had a tough Saturday morning. And so Phil's like, I'm good to go. I'm going to go play. And Justin's like, Hunter's playing great. Just keep him out there. And so everything was already set up. And sometimes you get to these events and it felt like we're figuring out Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday about who we're going to play with. And I remember in Wales, it wasn't Wales, but it was with Watson, Glenn Eagles. He said, you're going to go out with Jim Furyk. And I was like, all right. I hadn't played with Jim all week. And we were playing alternate shot. I hadn't hit his ball all week. It was like, okay, we ran out to the range and we're like, Jim, what do you use? And it was just kind of like, you know, that was a little frustrating. And it was tough about that week, but I love Jim Furyk and I couldn't wait to play with him, but I was just like, I wish I kind of played a little bit more with him that week to know that that was going
to
happen.
You need to be prepared for that.
Right. And that's what Paul did. He just set everything up to where he's like, you guys just go out and play and just enjoy the crap out about what you're going to experience. Cause I want this to be so much fun for you, because the fact is you made it on the team. The hard work's done. You worked 2 years to get to this point. Go have fun and enjoy it. And that's what we felt that all week, every day.
Tell me you have a framed picture or something from your putt on 17 and the singles.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah. I've got a different, there's a few pictures. Yeah, I've got one framed like that for sure.
Golf celebrations never look cool. And I can confidently say that's one of the best golf celebrations I think I've ever seen.
Well, it's hilarious that how much emotion comes out in those events. Now I felt like that kind of started it. You know, there was other times when you'd win, but it was, man, it was just so hyped up. And I was, you know, it was cool. Cause I was at, I played the Junior Ryder Cup and during Brookline, and we got to go on Thursday, Friday. They invited us out there. So it was cool to be a part of it as a young kid and see that. And I just, you know, Justin making that putt up the hill. We weren't there that day, but I remember watching on TV and that celebration. People are running on the green and he's just, it's just bonkers about what's going on. And that's what the Ryder Cup is about, and those team events. It's just, you get to just lay it all out there and just have fun.
One thing we love to joke about is you were sitting next to Phil at that press conference in the 2014 Ryder Cup when and your face is priceless as Phil, you know, Tom Watson is up there on the, you know, the ledge as well, sitting with you guys. And he basically just challenges the whole U.S. process. Right. And I'm wondering, you know, what you're thinking at that time as it's happening. It seemed to be the sentiment of the team, you know, that he was representing, and wondering if, you know, Phil, you thought Phil needed to do that publicly, or, you know, it seemed like change came after that moment. And I'm back and forth on whether that needed to be publicly done. But what are you sitting there thinking as Phil is doing that in the press conference?
Yeah, I mean, I think those events are so personal to us because we're in it when we're playing and we're trying, but sometimes we just don't have control over certain things. And that's a little frustrating. And it's frustrating for a guy like Phil, who's been a part of every team since the early 90s, right? And he knows kind of what works. And there's no one in the world I respect more than Phil Mickelson. I absolutely adore the guy. He's someone I look up to, and I call a great, great friend. We've talked about many different things, and he's someone I take great advice from in all sorts of areas. And I deeply respect his opinion on all kinds of things. And I think he just came to a head, and he was like, you know, some changes need to be made. Every year we hear about Europe has like this process, right? And they've had this process for a long time about the captains being assistant captains. Like they had a beautiful process about what they were doing and how they were doing things. And it was showing up because they were kicking our butt. And I just think he just sort of had enough. And I promise you, he talked to the PGA of America numerous times. Phil would not have done that unless he thought it was a last resort. And he talked to them over and over again about creating some sort of process and being a part of it and saying, hey, we kind of understand who we are and what we need, and let's create a pathway for each captain to be a part of it beforehand. Because it is a daunting thing to be a captain of a Ryder Cup like that or any team event. I mean, there is so much that goes into it to do it one time and to get it right would be so hard. And, you know, I mean, I think Phil just said, you know what, I got to do it. I got it. And I know he told us, he told me, he's like, I'm going to do it. And it's could be uncomfortable, but sometimes uncomfortable is exactly what you need in a lot of different situations. And that's just what we needed to make a little bit of a change. In no way did it, I don't think he meant any disrespect to Tom Watson, because I think all of us deeply respect Tom for the kind of the person he is and the player he is and the guy. I mean, it was more about the process than it was really about the individual.
Yeah, it's almost like it was directed at the PGA of America in a way of like, Tom came in and did what Tom was going to do, right? I mean, that's what he was brought in to do. So
absolutely,
it's not his fault in any way. But like, hey, looking at this from, you know, just in talking with even some people that are involved in the process of, you know, I'm like, hey, why did this decision get made? And the answer is, well, he just, you know, he had the most experience. And I just want to challenge that. I want to be like, man, like, constitutes a great leader, or the right process, or the person that's going to be the best in touch with these players and all these things? And you know, for a long time, it was you had to be a major champion to be a captain of one of these teams. And I'm like, do you even have to be a golf guy to be a captain of one of these teams? And I find the U.S.'s process improved, but still, I don't know if it's all the way there in terms of setting the team up to play their best possible golf, because it still seems like a very ceremonial, you know, honor that's given to people to be captains of these teams. But if we're really trying to win them, are we following the process that leads to the most success?
Yeah, and I think that's what Phil's message was at that time, was Europe has a plan and they have a plan of attack. And that's what it felt like. And what it really seemed like we were sort of lacking was they have a process in what they're doing. And you can't tell me that they're just better than us and they're beating us, but they feel so comfortable with what they're doing. And it's just, you can see in their play, they just have no doubt about what they're doing when they get there. Like, it's already done. And I think the hardest part for us as players was we didn't know what still was going on and who we were playing with. Going into, like I said, I didn't know I was playing with Jim until Saturday afternoon. And I was like, you know, that's a frustrating thing for a player, and changes need to be made. And at some point, someone's going to have to speak up, and it's okay to be uncomfortable. That's how things get done. And Phil's the great thing with Phil is he has so much respect with all the players and the PGA of America and the PGA Tour that when he said something, it has weight. And we all supported him in that way. And he has the guts, you know, and we've seen it through time. He has the guts to go out there and put himself out there. And I think we all really respected him for that because he wants to win and he wants to compete.
So let's go to the 2010 Ryder Cup, and we're not going to zoom straight to the end. I think everything from that week can kind of get dumbed down into how it ended. But what was that week like? You know, I really weirdly enjoy going back and watching the highlights from that, not to see the lavender sweaters or whatever those were. But I mean, it was a wild week weather-wise, starts and stops, just pure delays. They changed the whole format of the event, mid-event, and you finish on a Monday. What do you remember about all that?
Yeah, chaos. It felt a little bit like chaos. Yeah, there was no flow to the week at all, right? The weather was so rough. I remember the start, like it was just pouring down rain and it was like, what are we doing? Like, this is just a disaster. This is no energy of what you think of a Ryder Cup is going to be like. It was a pretty cool course, but it was just a mess. It just felt chaotic all week and it was hard to get a hold of what we were doing, and the course was just completely soaked. I felt like we played it up all week. It was just kind of wild. It definitely didn't have a great flow to it. So it was just kind of challenging that way.
Mm-hmm. And so when singles pairings come out, how do you end up in the spot that you're in? Do you know immediately like, hey, this could come down to me? When did you start to realize that things were kind of bubbling up to potentially come down to, you know, your match being the deciding match? And then I want to set the scene for how we get to the very end as well. But before we get there, you know, how did you end up in that spot?
I can't say I remember how. I just remember that we were down and we needed to front load the team and we really needed a lot of points early because it could get away from us the first probably 6 or 8 matches. I don't know. I think I was maybe second to last. I definitely wasn't last, but somewhere around there. And so it was really strange playing because everybody was already like all the fans were out there. There's like not many people really following us because everyone's watching, you know, the big names or whatever. But even then, like the match, you don't really know when the match is going to end and how things are going to turn out. And so it was, you're just kind of playing and not when we were by ourselves, but it was not a whole lot of like fanfare. You were just sort of in the background for a really long time. And then all of a sudden it was like, bang, here it is. You look at the scoreboard and it's coming down to this match.
You were out last, you were the 12th.
Match, I was.
I pulled
12th.
It out.
Okay.
Yeah. You and GMAC were 12th. And so, well, I think this is extremely important and almost, I'm wondering if you think this is lost to history that, you know, when you guys get to the 17th hole, you needed to win the last two holes. You know, it wasn't,
right. Yeah.
I would say we're looking at maybe a 15% probability here at the highest. I didn't do the math on that, but that's my estimation. I just want that noted because I feel like, I guess, do you feel like that part gets lost to history? And I know it doesn't make what happened after that probably any easier, but does that, you know, do you take any solace in that to say like you were battling an uphill climb at that moment to begin with?
Yeah, I remember he made a great birdie on 16.
Right.
16 was a pretty good challenging hole, and GMAC, the gamer and the putter that he is, rolled in a beautiful putt. I remember
it crept in on the low end, like it could have gone the other way.
Yeah, it was a good hole, it was a good birdie. I knew I was in trouble at that point, so we were not in good position at going into 17 for sure. It's not, I remember getting a ton of texts from people, you know, Azinger texted me right after that and Peter Jacobson, people I knew, and they were like, hey, this happened to you because you've got big shoulders and you can take it. And what you forget is that being in that situation means you did something right and you did something right for a long time. So, I felt proud. I love, it was so great to be in that. It was so fun, even though as emotionally draining it was and as hard as it was. GMAC is such a gentleman. I have so much love for that guy and so much respect for him. To go into battle with him in that situation was a lot of fun. And, you know, it was a sad moment, and it was tough, but I was playing the President's Cup and the Ryder Cup in front of millions of people. That's pretty cool. That's not an experience that, you know, losing something doesn't mean you lost. It just meant it wasn't your day. And yeah, I don't know. I just felt, like I said, you put so much work into that, to leave upset or sad about it would be a complete, it would be missing the point.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel like you, how do you feel like you were treated after that? Did you feel like most people were understanding in terms of golf fans? I'm sure your peers were, you know, obviously understanding. I mean, I just look at that image before you hit that chip of all those people on that hill. You're the only match out there, and a pressure that you cannot simulate in anything that you do ever in your life. And I'm just wondering kind of what you, if you felt more support or blame after that from golf fans or whatnot, and how you dealt with all that. It sounds like very well from what you just said, but I'm wondering what you remember feeling in those moments.
No, I think there's always going to be a small percentage of people who can't wait to, you know, I'm just glad Twitter wasn't around and social media wasn't around as prevalent back then. But no, I think everyone, empathy. I know the team. Yes, I remember getting into the locker room and I'm just like, it's so heavy. That week is, I remember Jeff Ogilvie said about playing the President's Cup. He said, it's the most fun you're going to ever going to have until you realize you're going to lose. And then he said, it just gets so heavy on you. You're like, oh crap, we lost. And so those weeks are so fun. You're amongst the best players in the world. And when you lose and lose in such a dramatic way, it's so heavy. It felt like it just like a, you know, an avalanche. But you know, the guys on the team were so great. And they, you know, every one of them came up to me afterwards and was like, hey, we lost. We came here as a team. We lost as a team. This is not something you, this is not a burden you carry around. So, you know, and I think guys always took so much offense to the fact that Europe was a better team than us. And we never really joined up together. And it was, that bothered us. And it was so ridiculous. We were just as much a unit as they were. And we bonded so incredibly well that week, that I never felt like any shame or anything of it, because I think people know that it's a game and it's, you know, it goes your way and sometimes it doesn't.
And not only that, after it happens, the wound is so incredibly fresh and you're asked to go up, you know, and face the media and discuss what just happened. And I remember watching that, and I don't know how you look back on that moment, but as a sports fan, I remember just being like, honestly, everything about this moment is what I love about golf and sports. Like that,
right?
You know, that this person had to be asked this question and put on this world stage, and it didn't go his way, and it means a ton to him for it to have not gone his way, and he is showing that in front of the world. And did you feel that sentiment from a lot of people that, you know, obviously I don't know. What do you feel when you go back or whenever you see highlights or think about that moment of having to kind of display that emotion in front of the world?
Yeah, I think the courage the courage you have to show and play golf for a living and do anything in front of people and expose yourself and be vulnerable like that is really challenging. Not a lot of people want to be exposed like that. And it was very humbling for me to be a part of that. And those are the moments that make you stronger, right? It might be a cliche, but it's so true. When you get undressed like that in a way, it does make you stronger, and it does make you realize how great it was. And like I said, you work so hard to be a part of that team and to have a struggle and a fight and a grit to compete against a bunch of great players. You can't leave there feeling sad or sorry for yourself, because that's just missing the point.
And you can't let it define you either, which you definitely,
not,
you know, it's,
you can't be a part of, you can't be a part of something like that and think that was a bad thing, right? Like that's where you want to be. That's an opportunity to be a part, to have great success. You're going to have to risk failure. And, you know, if you never really put it out there, then you have nowhere to fall. But It was all, I just enjoyed the team event so much. As everyone says, once you become part of one, you want to become a part of all of them, just because it's so fun to be in a group like that. And for that many days that you are one, you've got one common goal, and it's just so much fun.
Well, pro golf is lonely, and team golf is the opposite of lonely. It's the one time where, you know, you're on the same team as a lot of people. That's obvious, but you know, you're all together on the same mission. Whereas, you know, you play a major championship and you're out there with your buddies in that major championship, but when you all go separate ways that night and you're all going out trying to accomplish different goals the next day. So to get the 1 week a year that you get a totally different goal and, you know, energy around it, there's a reason why guys rave about it so much, I would have to imagine.
Oh, it's so fun. It's so cool. It's a throwback to being in college and to not being thinking about yourself. You know, you're really thinking about each other and having a common goal. It's really cool.
This is a tricky question, and always tough to, this is one that's put on the spot and hard to come up with an answer with something like this. But if I was to come up with a career comp for you, who would it be? 6 PGA Tour wins, a bunch of US team events, 7 straight tour championships, 2 WGCs, no majors. What's your career comp, would you say? I came up with one name last night that it kind of surprised me when I came up with it, but I'm wondering if you have one that comes up to the top of your head.
I can't. I can't wait to hear yours.
I said Ricky Fowler, and I know Ricky's got a lot of golf ahead of him and whatnot, but the records are surprisingly similar there.
Yeah, I think that's
a lot of top tens, a lot of top 25s, and
I think. I was probably thinking further back than that when I joined the tour. Well, that'd be a question I really have to think about.
Yeah, but you may have to get back to me on that one. But that's an interesting kind of game to play.
It is.
So you talked about being, you know, in pressure situations and you know, wanting to be there and whatnot. Well, what's it like playing a playoff, 2011 Tour Championship, a playoff for essentially $10 million? How does that compare to other pressure you've played under, both Ryder Cup and other tour events? And, you know, is that an amount of money that, you know, changes, that's almost like kind of impossible to ignore as you're playing?
Yeah, it's that, you know, at that time, the FedEx Cup was, you know, it's evolved
new.
Over
yeah.
time. Yeah, and it was, because I remember playing the final round and I just kind of, I gave myself a thought and a feeling that day was like, you know what, I'm going to go out there and play golf, and I'm just not going to react to anything. Anything negative. I'm just going to go out there and whatever happens. When it's positive, I'm going to enjoy it, but I'm just going to be in the moment. I'm going to do everything I can just to be in the moment, because there's so much that could happen, with where you finish. And where you finish in the tournament, and where you finish in the FedEx, it was so, it was just all over the place. Because where you finished, you know, I could have won that week, but not win FedEx. And so it was just so inconsistent, and it was all over the place. And so when I was playing, I just was playing to win the tournament and play the best I could. And until we, you know, I remember after it was over and Bill won, he didn't even know he was playing for the FedEx Cup, is what he said. He was like, I thought we were just playing for the tournament, because that's how complicated it was. And it was kind of hard to understand how each of us, because I remember I didn't win, lost the playoff, and I finished like 7th in the FedEx Cup points. But if I won the tournament, I would have won the FedEx. So it was, had that big a drastic change to it. So it was very difficult to figure out. And at the time, so it was, luckily it was so out there, you just didn't even worry about it. I knew about it when we were in the playoff, but beforehand it was hard to keep track of.
Well, you know, I meant to ask this when you mentioned you were gonna maybe play, you talked about AK with the 2008 team. Do you see AK around Dallas? Do you have much of a relationship with him? And what's, we try to get any info we can on him, and there's just not much out there.
No, I saw you know, it's kind of like an alien. He's kind of like a UFO. You think you saw it, but you're not really quite sure. You hear stories, but you can't quite confirm. But I know I saw Ryan Hibble, who's the Oklahoma Women's Golf Coach, and he saw him not too long ago. I know he spends a little time in Dallas, but he spends a lot of time in LA. So I don't know. I have not talked to him or heard of him. My agent was his agent when he played. And he kind of hears whispers about where he's, but he's just living life at this point. Hmm.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about Sean Foley, and kind of set the scene for the listeners for the timeline of you know, you guys working together, the successes you had together, and what, why he worked so well for you. Cause I feel like his reputation among golf fans, it's mixed, but there has to be a disconnect between, you know, the perception that some people have of him as a coach and why so many pros have trusted him with their swing. So how would you describe your experience working with Sean Foley?
Well, it's fantastic. I've always enjoyed being around him and talking to him, and we've had incredible success, and, you know, I think we'll have more. He is a true student of the swing. He spent hours and hours and hours in Canada giving lessons over and over and over again in trying to find it, you know, find the answer, find the reasons. And he spent a ton of time with guys from TrackMan and the biomechanics people. He goes above and beyond to try to figure out how he can be the best golf coach he can be from a swing perspective, from a psychological perspective, and figure out how can I best help the players be their very best. It's a very challenging thing to be a golf coach because it's very hard to get in the mind of a player and what they feel. He can see it. Any golf coach can kind of see things, but it is truly amazing that one player can go to five different coaches, get different opinions about what to do, but they can all show you the same image and say, this is what I want, but they'll all show you different ways to get there. I think it's interesting when I haven't been to a golf coach who hasn't had a picture of Hogan's swing somewhere in their house and where they teach. They're like, this is the swing we want. This is the GOAT right here, Ben Hogan. And every swing teacher looks at that and sees something different. So teaching is very, very challenging. I think Sean came out as like the biomechanics guy and the technology guy. And he uses, big words but that's just him. That's just kind of who he is and how he works. But he sees it very, very well and has worked tirelessly at trying to figure out how to make the swing simple and almost come up with a method that isn't really a method, but be able to manipulate it to where the swing is instinctive. And as we've talked about a lot, is almost reactive and not trying to put it somewhere, but it's reacting the right way. And you're incentivized to do the right things. And then how do we get to these certain positions? So it's very challenging being a golf coach, but he puts a ton of work in to be the very best that he can be at multiple disciplines to help the player just play his very, very best.
I'm not sure how to ask this question, but the balance between being technical and trusting a golf swing, how do you find that? And I imagine the more you're kind of struggling with a golf swing, the harder it is to not get technical, right? You're trying to, in almost all, guarantee there's a technical issue when things are not going right that you need to get in touch with, you need to figure out, yet your best golf is going to be played when you're probably not thinking technically on the golf course. How has that kind of relationship between, trusting a swing and getting very technical evolved over the course of your career? And how are you dealing with that now?
Usually anyone that I've talked to about playing my best, they always talk about the zone. How do you get in the zone? How do you just be quiet and sort of have a quiet mind and see just what you want to do? There's always a lot of steps to that. Every player has a different pre-shot routine and a different methods to how they feel comfortable, right? Because you're trying to get comfortable with what you're doing. And some guys like a lot of swing thoughts. Some guys don't have very many. I think you look at Bryson, how he goes about it, and you look at Dustin, how he goes about it. Dustin, you can just tell it's very fluid. He sees it, he reacts to it. You know, Bryson, I don't know what he's thinking when he's hitting a shot, but I think he loves to think about it and take out variables on every swing, and he wants to know everything about everything, you know, and it's kind of fun playing with different players because you can see that how they go about it is so different. As I talked about with kind of Sean, I have to get my swing to a place where I'm incentivized and it's very reactionary to where I just do it. And so for me, you know, getting the backswing into a good position to where the downswing, which takes no time at all, is just my body and the club are completely synced and doing the right thing to where when I hit the shot, I don't really feel too much in my hands. And I just go through it and I feel like there's very, very little happening, but I have to have a really good backswing. I have to have a lot of time. I can't be in a hurry, to get to the right place. And then from there, you know, the downswing takes no time at all. So there's no time to think or fix anything. It's amazing whenever I talk to Tiger, when he's working with Sean, how much he feels in the hands. I don't consider him a real handsy player, but he feels everything with his hands. And then like that's his connection between his body and the club, right? It's obvious, but he can really, it's amazing what he can do with just, you know, that little feel. Like he's so feely oriented. It's really, you know, it feels like you're talking to, you know, an artist like Van Gogh. Like he can just, he has another sense when it comes to the swing. And so he can really feel it and understand it and does a lot through his hands, even though it doesn't really look like it. So anytime a player is not thinking and they can just react, especially in pressure situations, that's a great thing.
I think I have the answer to this based on, you know, the passion in which you've answered pretty much every question I've asked so far, but after a few years of struggling, I'm wondering, does golf still bring you joy? If I just asked it, open like that, does golf bring you joy? What would your answer be?
I enjoy it. I wish I was playing better.
But you mentioned the enjoying the pursuit that you're on, right? You going and working on things, you still enjoy that. So I took that to say that it does still bring you joy, even if the results on the course aren't great.
I do enjoy the feeling of a good shot and feeling like you're gaining on it, but it is still a results-based business. Like I go out to practice to go play well. And when you don't play well, it's still a kick in the teeth. It doesn't feel good. And so it's still very challenging some tournament weeks, especially, you know, when you play a bunch in a row, it is daunting to go into the next day because the only experience you have is a little bit of frustration. So it's very hard to every day. The challenge for me is to just today is today. It has nothing to do with yesterday in terms of result and what's going to happen, because today is brand new and I don't know what's going to happen. But if I don't think that good things are going to happen, then they won't. So it's that's tournament golf, and that's the challenge of a career when it's not going great, turning that around, because I do feel like physically I can do anything. You know, Bryson DeChambeau put on 30 pounds and he's hitting it like a long drive guy. Physically, you can do anything. You really can. But you can't lose that belief, because once you lose that, the physical part really is irrelevant. And you really got to start putting in that mental time of, I can do this. I can, you know, it's like looking in the mirror, as silly as it sounds, but you've got to pump that into your brain, into your body. Hey, I can do anything. I really can. This isn't Tiger Woods and Bryson. They're not magicians. They're not, you know, waving their wand. They just put in the work and they've found a way to where they feel their very best and they go out and do it and they play with complete confidence and without fear. So it's there's nothing stopping me. I just got to keep doing it and keep grinding and take, it's definitely a transition from taking all the good swing stuff that I'm doing, because I do feel like it's getting better, and I've got to start turning that into on the course success. And I believe I can do it, because I don't think that there's anything stopping me except myself.
Wow. My next question was going to be like, do you honestly and truly believe that you can be as good as you once were? And it sounds like you really truly, and you're not just telling yourself that, you actually really do believe that.
I 100% do. I really do. I do feel like I've looked at a lot of like old swings of mine because I want to find what I did well back then and still improve off of that and figure out, I had an okay short game, but I want to be better than that. I want it to be better, and it's challenging. But I'm like, I can do that. It's just a physical thing. There's nothing stopping you from being great. You know, it's like Steph Curry. There's nothing stopping him from being a 6'2", 6'3" guy in a sport where size and physical talent and prowess matter. And he's doing it with skills and work and shooting a bunch of threes and changing the game. There's nothing stopping any player from doing that. You know, like everyone talks about golfers getting bigger and stronger, and Colin Morikawa, he's not 6'4". He's not bombing at 330 yards, even though he hits it plenty far, but he plays golf his way and it's super successful and he's going to be successful. So you got to believe and you got to know what you can do well and go out and try to do that every day.
I found a particular quote from you interesting. It was a 2018 interview, and I forget where I pulled this from. Apologies for that. But you said that you hadn't had many struggles in your life and that this was foreign territory to you. I just found that interesting because, you're a fast success in the game of golf and didn't sound like there was much turmoil off the course really in your life to this point. And I just found that perspective interesting not having had struggles in your life until your golf game was kind of wandering in a different direction.
Yeah. Like I said, I'm an only child. I've got two amazing parents who weren't divorced. I was supported, from a young age into anything I wanted to do. I had great lessons. I was able to see, Tom Sargent in California when I was just starting to play golf. I moved to Texas and I saw Randy Smith, who's an incredible teacher, in Dallas. Stability at home, really anything my dad and mom would do, anything I didn't even ask for. They would just do it because they thought it would help me become a better golfer. I traveled all around with tournaments. Like, you couldn't have a better life than I did as a kid and better opportunities. I mean, just, I'm sure there is, but like, you know, it was pretty awesome. It was pretty flawless. Struggled a little bit from college, kind of like my freshman second semester to my when I transferred to Oklahoma State. There was a little tough time there. I just wasn't comfortable at USC, and I transferred. And then all of a sudden, being around Coach Holder and the Oklahoma State program really shifted me into high gear to being a great player. And he, Holder was a huge part of my success there and turning me into a better PGA Tour player. And then, like I said, it's, when you talk about I think what I was talking about was real struggle and real turmoil. Like, I had everything you would want in life. There's no, and I think what I was getting at was like, no one needs to feel sad for me that my career hasn't gone great. No one needs to worry about me. And I don't think anyone is, but I think I was just making the point was I've had a great life and a great career. And I do believe that I can still go, play great golf moving forward in this time, that it's just a reality that golf is hard, and any of the successes that I've had and these players have had today is earned. It is 100% earned, and everything those guys get is because they work their butt off to get it, and that's for anyone's successes in any sport or anything in life.
Man, doing interviews, I kind of listen for the little 1 to 2 minute clips that we'll get that we'll share on social to try to get people to listen. You gave them like 10 of them. I don't even know what we're going to pick for this, but we're going to let you out because I'm going to demand that you come back on the pod at some point in the future. But I think we've covered pretty much everything except for, and you're the first one from this group that we've ever had on the podcast, so I finally get to ask about it.
Oh boy.
The golf boys. What the hell was that?
That's a great question. I remember it manifested from It was funny. I think it manifested from Ben Crane and Rory Sabatini having their you know slow play spat at Congressional. Honestly, I think that people were like, you know, they kind of rallied around Ben a little bit, and because they felt so bad for him that Rory did that, and then it led. I think Ben did some little videos online at the time and got some fun feedback. I could be wrong. I don't want to, but I just remember Ben gaining some notoriety. And if you know Ben, he is the most positive, fun guy you'd ever want to meet. I love him so much. And it just kind of like started to grow a little bit. And then Bubba, Ricky just came on tour and Bubba was kind of, becoming a name, and you know, I was like, yeah, I do something. And so we were all kind of buddies and played a lot, and it was like, we'll do something musical. I don't know how the music thing came about, but it just, you know, we did the first one and it was so ridiculous and silly, and I just remember doing it like, this is like dumb as could be, I don't know what's happening. And then we did a second one for some silly reason, but you know, we tried to create a charity aspect to it, and we did, and it was kind of fun that way. I think Farmers the first time donated. I mean, they had so many views that you know, I think Farmers charity, and then we try to do it another time, and like any bands, it's four you know separate entities trying to figure out how to make this work the best way, and it just became like too much to handle, but it was fun at the time, and it created a following. Oh my gosh. For the time, everywhere we went, golf boys, man, it's a golf boy. It was so funny. We're like, this is crazy. I mean, for something so silly and ridiculous to everything that happened since for quite a few years afterwards was pretty funny. Even on Twitter today, people are like, during the pandemic, they were like, Golf Boys 3, perfect time to
get back together.
Release it. We were like, oh, and nobody, none of us have had any interest in doing it. just funny. It's just, you know, it was kind of that was like social media before social media, right? Like some weird video craze that has taken off, right? So that's just kind of what happens.
Awesome. Well, hey, man, really, really appreciate the time and insights. This has been fascinating. It's lived up to, you know, everything I'd hoped it would be, but would love to have you back sometime. And I know a lot of people will be following your journey, your comeback here, you know, round by round. And we really, really appreciate the time and insight.
Hey, I love what you guys do. It's an absolute pleasure for me. Keep doing what you guys are doing. It's fun and fascinating. I think you guys add something to golf that is sorely needed. You know, golf's a great game. It's fun. It should be fun. And I love what you guys do. And I know you guys are going to keep crushing it.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Hunter. Really appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything.